Thank you very much, Professor Sufio. It's a great honor to have been invited to be in this noble hall of learning. And following the many distinguished speakers yesterday and today, to report to you the condition of solidarity in China. Now, yesterday, we have the distinguished Professor Robert of Collège de France mentioned a term when he discussed Japanese Buddhist tradition. He mentioned an interesting term, rantai, as a translation or expression of the idea of solidarity. That reminds me that I should add two footnotes to my paper. Both have to do with the great influence of France in modern China. The first note is about the term solidarity. Now, at the moment I'm speaking English to you, and I use the term solidarity, but that is not Chinese. And in China, the idea of rantai, or in Mandarin, liandai, is a common civil law term. It does not mean solidarity anymore. It means a kind of vicarious liability at civil law. The term we use to express the idea of solidarity is a compound word in two characters called the tuan jie, T-U-A-N. Tuan means to group together. And the second character, jie, J-I-E, means to tie a knot, to tie up. Now, in China, of course, this immediately recalls a great French influence, a great song of 1871 in Paris, that is L'International. The refrain of that song says, this is the final struggle, hein? C'est la lutte finale.
It's up to you to sing the international.
And then it says, groupons-nous et demain. And the Chinese translation goes, "团结," or unite till tomorrow. Now that's one association with the international labor movement and the revolutionary tradition in 20th century China. So when we talk about solidarity in Chinese, we talk about let us group together, let us unite together. This is one note. I will come back to this later. The other note is has to do with a sort of mystery about the success, the great success of capitalism in today's China. That mystery has drawn many bad predictions by observers of Chinese economy, observers of Chinese politics. And they often ask the question, when will China collapse? But it never did. It went on, and now for over three decades, the capitalism seems flourishing. But from the point of view of solidarity or tuanjie, we may ask a different question. How this restored system, which is based on private ownership and a capitalistic employment relationship, how does it work with a very different political system, very different legal system in China, as from what happened in the West? In other words, what's the relationship between this old capitalist system and a revolutionary tradition? Now, it happened a couple of years ago, a French classic, a book, was recommended by the Communist Party senior officials to throughout the echelon of the Communist Party. The book is from the pen of a great French thinker and historian. His name is Alexis de Tocqueville. And interestingly, this is not a book about American democracy, but a later work called The Old Regime and the Revolution, L'Ancien Régime et la Révolution. Now, as soon as people hear about that, people think about, wow, why are the senior officials thinking about Tocqueville, thinking about the L'Ancien Régime and the Revolution? Does it mean that the revolution is on the horizon again, or does it mean capitalism as L'Ancien Régime has got some trouble? But economically, it is not the case. Economically, China fares well during the global financial crisis. Chinese enterprises adopted new policies, new strategies in the global market. They are doing quite well. And the political system, of course, theoretically is not for capitalism, but it works with well. So I think my report has to do with this recommendation of the Tocqueville's book. But before turning back to that, I would like to report to you a little story about a strike. And then we will discuss the legal issues. This is a strike that happened 3 years ago in the southern province of Guangdong, or Canton, where there is a base for the Honda company, the automobile manufacturer. In the year 2010, in the month of May, by the way, May is the month for international labor in China. So almost in the climate of some labor unrest, the Honda workers went on strike. Ordinarily, in the past, before that, such a mass event was called in Chinese a mass event, meaning a get-together of people without approval. It's called a mass event. Such mass event usually ended quickly. But this time, it's different. The Honda industrial action did not submit to the usual measures of control by the management and the company's trade union. Now, currently in China, all trade unions are official trade union organized as sort of para-government, as the sole representative of all workers in China. And in reality, trade union works closely with the management rather than with the workers. So despite the effort to control, such as threats of layoff, or individual offers, or beatings by thugs hired by the trade union, or calling in the police, nothing worked. The strike continues. Even after Honda summarily fired the leader, Mr. Tan, a youth, a 24-year-old migrant worker, and even after the company asked all the employees to sign a pledge not to join the walkout in exchange of 55 yuan per month as a bonus. Now, 55 yuan is about 7 euro. So you can imagine it's very, very cheap labor. The strike continued. The protest rallied at the factory gate, all in white uniform and surgical masks to avoid being identified by the surveillance cameras and targeted for reprisal. And they did one thing that surprised the management and the trade union. They sang the national anthem of China. I attached as an appendix in the paper the words of this song. The song was born in 1935 during the war against Japanese aggression. That war continued for years and eventually became part of World War II. And the song goes like this: "Arise, ye who refuse to be slaves. With our very flesh and blood, let us build our new great wall." Great wall refers to the great wall, ancient great wall in China. "The Chinese nation is at its most perilous hour. Everyone must roar a final time. Arise, arise, arise. Millions of masses of one mind." This is an idiom, old idiom, which means 团结 or solidarity. "Millions of masses of one mind. Brave the enemy's fire. March on. Brave the enemy's fire. March on, etc." Now they sang this song. The anthem is called March of the Volunteers. Volunteer refers to the volunteer army or militia during the war. And interestingly, of course, the Honda management are Japanese. Right? So if you sang the national anthem, it's kind of a challenge to, by historical reference, to the Japanese aggression. So some observers say, well, this is simply a strategy on the part of the strikers to challenge the Japanese management. But soon, this becomes a common phenomenon. You know, in all kinds of strikes, labor unrest, people sing this song, regardless of who the management is. The second thing the strikers do is that they go on internet. Now, this is the second generation of migrant workers. They are better educated than their parents. Many of them spend some hours on internet frequently. So they went on internet and formed what's called the QQ, a Chinese version of internet chat room. And in the QQ communities, they addressed each other as comrades. Now again, comrades is an English translation of the term 同志, which means friends of one will, a common will of, among the friends, 同志. And this personal appellation, again, is from the 20th century revolution. It started from Dr. Sun Yat-sen's revolution to overthrow the Qing dynasty, and it was taken over by the Nationalist Party as well as the Communist Party. And today, it is also the usage in China's gay subculture. The gay and the lesbian people address each other as 同志 or comrades. So the strikers take over this term and address each other as 同志 or comrades. Normally or officially, this appellation is kind of very, very formal and ceremonious. And in daily life, the average person in the street would feel embarrassed if you addressed him or her as comrade. But here it is different. It is a strike, and the strikers call each other comrades, as in a revolution. Now, the strikers raise their demands. The first demand is to reorganize the company's trade union, because the trade union is on the side of the management. They want to reorganize it. Secondly, a pay raise of 800 yuan or 100 euro per month. This is a pay raise. And thirdly, no reprisal whatever after the strike. It happened perhaps by accident or perhaps because someone high up noticed the strike. Anyway, on May the 28th, the Communist Party organ, People's Daily, published a special report on the Honda strike. And according to observers, this is unprecedented. For the first time in over three decades, the chief organ of the party propaganda apparatus gave such lengthy coverage of what described as a cessation of work on account of labor-capital dispute. What is more, the report carefully maintained a neutral position and pointed no fingers at the migrant workers. All sided with the management. So many scholars and commentators on the media called for a rule of law to handle labor disputes. Rule of law in exchange of the usual harsh suppression under the prevailing policy of keeping stability. Now, keeping stability is a slogan of the previous administration in the last 10 years. Under this policy, a harsh suppression is often justified to suppress labor unrest. But this time it's different. Because, in the observer's words, such policy is likely to aggravate the conflict and drive the masses of workers to become opponents to the party rather than what the party should rely upon. Now, this reference is to the orthodox theory. That theory says the Communist Party in its relationship to the people should be harmonious, right? The especially the working class. Working class is what the party should rely upon. Now, with this publicity on the official newspaper as well as on the internet, the workers become very bold. They published an open letter to the general public, to all walks of the society. And under the tremendous public pressure, the management reconciled. So eventually the two sides reached an agreement and the strike successfully ended. Now, what happened next is really amazing because the company trade union did get reorganized. The workers made an election, they cast the votes, they elected their own representatives, and the new trade union, therefore, is a different union. The union officials are no longer appointed by the government or chosen from the management, but they are the average migrant workers themselves. And that union led the further collective bargaining with the Honda management. And indeed, other Honda facilities in the province joined the new trade union to negotiate for their pay raise and other issues, such as labor protection. And that draws a lot of attention, a lot of discussion among the legal community, the jurists, lawyers, labor activists. And the issue is raised whether the workers actually restored a right called the right to strike. Now, this is our interesting issue if we apply legal analysis. In China today, the right to strike or the freedom to strike is nowhere in the statute. Formerly, before 1982, this right is listed in the Constitution. In the Constitution of 1975 and the Constitution of 1978. But in 1982, after the Communist Party Central Committee resolution on the Cultural Revolution, this right is canceled. They revised the Constitution, and this right is canceled. The official explanation is that in a socialist country, the workers share a fundamental interest with the state enterprises, the two sides should work together to resolve any difference. And a strike or labor unrest will cause unnecessary disruption in the production. Moreover, the right to strike is attributed to the what's called the ultra-left trend of thought of the Cultural Revolution. In other words, it became a symbol of the Maoist area. Because the chairman Mao Zedong himself, supported the right to strike. And in fact, it is on his personal request that the constitution was revised to have this provision in the constitution during the Cultural Revolution. And now, since the revolution was no longer there, the right is canceled. Along with it, the other Maoist provisions are canceled too. These are the four great freedoms enshrined in the previous constitution. The freedoms to criticize government authority, the freedom to post big characters, posters, which is also a form of a debate during the Cultural Revolution, etc., etc. So under the new policy of Deng Xiaoping, the right of strike is no longer there. Now, without the support of the Chinese constitution, it's very difficult for jurists or for lawyers or for a judge to justify the position of the workers' right to strike, right? So this engenders a lot of discussion for labor activists who want to justify labor's position in labor unrest. One argument goes like this. Since China has acceded to the United Nations Convention on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, and that convention provides a right to strike, and therefore the argument goes, China has an obligation to fulfill in terms of the workers' right to strike. But the problem is, without an enabling statute in the municipal law, you cannot make then an argument in litigation or make an argument in labor arbitration. It just stays on the paper. It's not a real right that you can make and demand. So the problem becomes, what kind of right the workers achieved in strikes such as the Honda strike I described to you? Now, it happened that, again, I need to introduce a little bit of philology here. It happened the word right in Chinese is a very ambiguous term. Usually, in official document too, the word or character used to translate the Western idea of a citizen's right is called the quan, Q-U-A-N, pronounced as quan in Mandarin Chinese. But the quan does not mean a personal right or property right in itself. The root meaning of the character is the weight of a steel yard or of a scales, whereby you're weighing things. As a verb, the word means a measurement or to exercise a judgment or the ability to do so. And by extension, the power, the authority, or in French, the puissance, to make a judgment, to exercise one's ability. Now, therefore, in the parlance of the strikers, what they gain by the trend to strike is not limited to a personal right or a social right. It is a power. They gain a power or authority as opposed to the management, as opposed to the government policy. It is therefore a repoliticization of labor movement. It is not a rule of law strategy as suggested by we jurists. On their part, since the Constitution no longer guarantees this freedom, it is a repoliticization on their part to say to the government, as well as the official union and the management, here is our trend, our power, our authority in the form of whatever you call it, a right to, that we gain by singing to you this song, the national anthem. And it happened, the words of the national anthem resembles that of l'intérêt national. It refers to slave. It refers to people who refuse to be slaves. It refers to the action of arise, right? The boo. And it therefore calls back a great tradition in the 20th century. That is to say, the tradition of Mao Zedong. Now, it happened that Mao himself, in his youth, has addressed many trade unions in the 1920s. And he also interpreted the three rights or three trend of labor. Now, three trend of labor is the Chinese translation of the Western idea of the right to form trade union, right of solidarity, right to go on strike, right to conduct collective bargaining. But the chairman has a different interpretation. Now, here is his interpretation. In 1921, when he addressed to the first trade union in his province, in Hunan province, in central China, he said, the trade union should exercise three trend, or three powers. The first power is the power of subsistence, which means everybody has a right to of living, especially those under 18 who are not yet on the job market, and who are beyond 60 years old, who have sold up all the labor and now reached age to go to retirement. Everybody should have a right or power of subsistence. Secondly, he said, the trend is about labor itself. And he quote what he described as an immemorial principle of a heavenly principle. In his words, the heaven grants mercy on trees and herbs, regardless it's yellow or green, strong or weak. And to me, as a biblical scholar, it's very interesting because it reminds me of Jesus' teaching. About the Heavenly Father makes the sun rises on the righteous and the unrighteous alike, and he makes the rain on the just and unjust, regardless of the behavior. And Mao said, well, heaven is like this. The heavenly principle is for provision of everybody. So if an able-bodied laborer is unemployed, the society has an obligation to pay him or her a regular salary. And finally, the trend is for the full harvest of the fruits of labor. In other words, it resembles St. Paul's teaching that those who do not labor should not eat. Everybody should work. And Mao said, of course, this is a trade union principle. The workers are entitled to harvest all the fruits of labor to the extent that those who do not labor should be deprived of their share, which means, of course, the overthrow of the capitalist class. And he pointed out that is not an immediate goal in the 1920s, but if you look to the north, to Russia, people already did that. And that, of course, it refers to his own revolution. So in conclusion, coming back to the first the footnote that I mentioned about Tocqueville's book, L'Ancien Régime and the Revolution, it's interesting to know today that even senior officials within the party have noticed this relationship between the revolution and the capitalist system. In other words, what prevents the new capitalism in China from collapsing, from going into open class conflict? There must be something. There must be something there that holds it back and maintains the smooth operation of capitalism. And I think that the national anthem has something to do with that. I think the teaching of Mao is there behind it. It is a permanent threat, permanent warning there, and the party or whoever in power must watch out, must measure carefully in this good Chinese term of trend, making it a good measurement. It's a good measurement or good judgment on the part of the party as well as on the party of the strikers. Both sides are using the trend or the power of the authority to negotiate. And that seems to me is a sort of maintenance of this new capitalism. Thank you very much.
Merci beaucoup pour cet exposé très, très instructif, très subtil. Donc, en quelques mots, je pense que vous avez tous suivi sans peine, mais en quelques mots. Donc, le professeur Xiang a commencé son exposé par le récit d'une grève qui est intervenue en 2010 dans une usine Honda, et dont le leader était un jeune homme de 24 ans, appartenant à ce qu'on appelle les travailleurs migrants, c'est-à-dire ce qui désigne en Chine les ruraux qui viennent travailler, les travailleurs paysans, on appelait ça dans l'histoire sociale française, sans avoir forcément les papiers qui leur permettent d'accéder justement aux mêmes avantages et aux mêmes prérogatives que les urbains. Et cette grève se référait dans les grévistes à deux outils qui ont permis que cette grève soit un succès. Et la première, c'était qu'ils ont chanté l'hymne national, et l'hymne national chinois qui affirme qu'il faut refuser d'être esclave. Donc c'est un hymne qui est très imprégné par le thème de l'international, donc refuser l'esclavage et exiger une juste condition. Et d'autre part, ces jeunes grévistes ont fait également un usage innovant de l'Internet qui a conduit à ce que cette grève soit un succès et qu'ils puissent avoir leurs propres représentants avec une éviction plus ou moins grande des syndicats jaunes qui jusqu'alors se trouvaient dans cette entreprise. À partir de ce cas, M. Xiang en est venu à une approche juridique de la notion de droit de grève autour d'un commentaire de la notion de Tren, écrite Quan, Q-U-A-N, Ansheng n'étant plus là, je me sens plus à l'aise pour massacrer la prononciation du chinois. Et ce terme correspond, sous sa forme verbale, à l'idée de mesurer, d'exercer son jugement, et donc par extension d'exercer un pouvoir. Et donc les notions de droit et de pouvoir n'ont pas dans cette terminologie la claire distinction que nous pouvons faire dans la terminologie juridique occidentale. À partir de là, M. Xiang proposait de voir dans la grève une sorte de réappropriation du pouvoir politique par les travailleurs qui s'appuie, enfin c'est pas à l'imparfait parce que ce qui nous est décrit ici est un processus en cours en Chine, qui s'appuie sur un appel fait au fondement politique du régime, c'est-à-dire à ce qui restait du maoïsme comme espérance d'émancipation des travailleurs. Et il s'est référé à cet égard à un discours fameux prononcé par Mao le 1er mai 1921 et décrivant quels étaient ses principaux pouvoirs ou droits dont les travailleurs devaient exiger le respect, c'est le pouvoir de faire vivre sa famille, le droit au travail et le droit à la répartition des fruits du travail, tout cela mis sous le chapeau de la sainteté du travail, du caractère sacré, respectable du travail. Et donc, en conclusion, M. Xiang nous a dit qu'au fond, ce qui maintient, ce qui permet au capitalisme, à la chinoise, d'éviter l'effondrement, c'est justement cette possibilité de réactiver un pouvoir des masses qui rappelle le pouvoir politique à ses devoirs dans une société communiste. Donc je vous remercie beaucoup. J'espère que vous trouvez mon résumé retraduit à peu près fidèle et ne pas vous avoir trop trahi. Je trouve cette approche extrêmement intéressante pour plusieurs raisons. D'abord parce qu'elle nous rappelle que sous solidarité aussi, il y a la solidarité dans l'action et dans la lutte. Bon, dans le droit du travail, la forme principale de solidarité, c'est quand même la grève. Donc ce thème de la grève est une entrée que nous n'avions pas du tout explorée, pratiquement, sauf au travers de l'exposé de Pierre Rodière. Et d'ailleurs, il y a des rapprochements à faire sur le traitement de l'Union européenne et de la Chine. Et d'autre part, c'est un rappel à la précaution nécessaire à employer en matière comparative dans l'idée de l'exportation de la notion de droit de grève. On prend pour acquis que la notion de droit subjectif ou de droit individuel est une notion aisément exportable, alors qu'elle donne lieu à des réassimilations et réinterprétations. D'où la nécessité toujours en droit comparé pour recontextualiser, car le droit comparé est aussi exposé aux utilisations sauvages que l'anthropologie, ainsi que nous l'a décrit Danuta Libersky hier.